It's terrible.
Okay. Okay, so. Yeah, okay, no worries. Let me try this little demonstration here. And by the way, on this recording, this is before the actual talk. So we have a circle, and if you're demonstrating a circle, boy, now this is going to get complicated, but let's just pretend this circle is made of like spaghettis curled in a, or a cinnamon roll or something like that. And we took a knife and we sliced into the center, boom, like this. And if we would, let's just pretend these are all, sort of like pieces here. Ooh, that's nice and straight. Okie dokie, here we go. Nice straight circle, there you go. Anyway, so can anybody tell me the formula for finding area in a circle?
Pi times radius squared.
Area equals pi times radius squared. I actually couldn't remember what it was. So if we would take this guy right here, and we would take all these little pieces out, and we would pull them out, it would make it into a, and maybe you can tell me how this works, because I can't remember, but it would make it into a triangle. We would start with this first little piece, it would be a little triangle, the ends would actually be crooked, but we'll pretend they're straight, and the next piece would be a little longer, next piece would be a little longer, and the next piece would be a little longer, whoa, Charlie. Okay, it goes on like this. Actually, they would be a lot longer in proportion. Like, the curve should be a lot steeper, right? And then we end up, this would be all the pieces of this circle, and then we could find the area here somehow. It's a really nifty little way of demonstrating it. And like I say, it was all written out. Would one of you guys want to come give it a stab? Okay, let's just... I want you to know this would be an amazing little demonstration. Anyway, you know what? So we're done with that. So last time we just got done with some Greeks and they were strange. And we're going to do a little bit more about history. And then I want to talk to you a little bit about alternate ways of thinking of learning math, which some of us have run into. Because right after all these Greeks were doing these amazing things and getting all these things accomplished, the Romans came and took over, and Romans are not known for thinking very deeply. All they want to do is build roads and big buildings and make war and do all kinds of things, really important things like that. And they decided that, you know what, mathematics is a waste of time. And a little bit later, they decided that not only was mathematics a waste of time, but when the Holy Roman Empire became holy and Christian, they decided that mathematics was paganism. And so they went down to the Great Library of Alexandria, and they burned it to the ground. And this ended all the discoveries of math for centuries and centuries in Europe. For centuries, no new discoveries were made. They used Roman numerals for everything, which is a really terrible way to do mathematics, as we kind of talked about. And every new idea that came up was concluded to be heresy by the church, and stamped out brutally, and so there were fewer and fewer new ideas. It seems that every time religion takes over a country completely, these ideas, this sort of absolute control freak, closed-minded dogmaticness sort of takes over. And we see that today. Okay, we know Christianity was that in the Dark Ages, right? But I think we see that today in the religion of evolution around us. The new discoveries and the amazing things that people find, when it doesn't fit into this little window of evolution, it's destroyed. It's lost. It's forgotten. It's covered. It's distorted. And we see it in radical Islam today. when they believe what they want to believe instead of seeking God's truth in creation, then beautiful things are destroyed. Anyway, that was a little bunny trail. But while the Christian world was silent, other countries were making some amazing strides. And we're going to visit some of those other countries. China was making fantastic mathematical discoveries using little sticks. They didn't write numbers. They used, and those are some examples of their little sticks. And that is what they used to write numbers. And they had actually a really good number system. And I'm going to write a number for you here that the Chinese would have written. And it looks like this. And these are supposed to be the same length. I'm looking on my paper, but I learned how to write in this lingo in preparation for this class, but I forget all the rules, so I'm looking off my paper. So here we are, 4, 3, 9, 9, 74. All right? But they didn't write it. They didn't make the hieroglyphics. They used the literal sticks. And they became so good at manipulating their sticks and doing things with their sticks, they did some amazing things with math. They understood the concept of zero. They didn't have zero. They didn't fully understand it, but they left, like when one of these numbers was supposed to be a zero, if this was supposed to be a zero, they would leave it blank, and they would leave a gap in their stick table, which was actually... It was starting to think really far outside the box of the numbers of the day. And they did some other neat... One interesting thing, they had positive numbers and negative numbers, which was a really big stretch for them, and they used their little sticks to make them, and the positive numbers were red, and the negative numbers were black, because Chinese thought that red is a little better than black. And it wasn't actually until about 1500 AD that some... Luca Pacioli, or however you say his name, published a book, his double-entry bookkeeping standard that we use today, where the negative numbers are red and the positive are black. But the Chinese had us beat by centuries, but they had it switched around. Anyway, it's kind of neat. But you can make any number in anywhere into the millions and millions using only a maximum of 5 rods. And it was where they were sitting on the table in relation to each other, to what number they are. You see this 9 and this 9, the only difference is a little space. And that tells you its place value. So it's really neat, a different way of thinking about it. They got really good at doing this, but you can imagine, so they have this equation or whatever laid out on the table, and you know the little child comes along and bumps it, and it's all over, you know. There's some limitations to using sticks for your math class. They used these rods for about 1,000 years until they started using the abacus. And we often think of the abacus as being sort of Chinese because, I mean, if you go down to Chinatown in San Francisco today, they're still clicking around on their abacuses. It's really cool. And you know what? I bought an abacus. I have a book that tells you how to run an abacus, and I messed around with it. But honestly, I have no idea how you run those things. It's just little balls, but you guys will figure it out, no problem. The abacus actually existed over 3,000 years before the Chinese got a hold of it. And it was in we find records of it in Mesopotamia, or people find records of it. And remember the Mesopotamians with their base 60 number system that we talked about a little bit yesterday? The ancient Arabic word for dust is abak, which suggests that maybe the abacus was drawn in the dirt with pebbles for representing the numbers. And it's really neat because there's your blackboard wherever you need to go. Even our word for counters in stores, when you go to the checkout counter, harks back to a time when counting was done on a table at a checkout. So that's a little bit of that. The word for calculate actually comes from the Greek word calculi or calculi, which means literally a stone or a pebble. So this is what they use these physical little things to do their calculations, which actually gave them a real leg up. There you go. On the rest of the world, because they thought a little bit differently about numbers. They're not trying to use this abstract
abstract number system in their heads where the numbers are represented. They had these physical things they manipulated, and it helped them make the math a little bit in their, more better in their minds. So there was a play written about 400 years before Christ, and this is probably hundreds of years before the abacus made it to China, where a Greek writer named Alexis talks about men that sometimes stand for more or less, like the pebbles on an abacus. So that's kind of neat. So the Chinese also loved magic number squares, and there are some really neat little magic number squares. And like you can, we talked about yesterday the great scientists and numbers geniuses of history. They used, they loved numbers and they liked to play with numbers. And in doing so, they made some of the neatest discoveries ever. And this is one number square that I really like because it's really simple and I get my mind all wrapped around it. So we write it like this, and I'm sure you've probably seen this one. So it's actually supposed to be more or less a diamond, right? So now on our next step on this little, on this magic, this not magic, but this number square, we swap the corners around. So the 1 and the 9 will get switched around, so we'll go 9. Well, this is going to be really hard for me, just saying. Actually, you know what, let's do like this. We're going to switch the 1 and the 9. And we're going to switch the 3 and the 7. All right? And now we're just going to kind of squish it together and squish the top into the into these gaps right here. So it would be 4, 2, no, that's not right. 4, 9, 2, 3, 5, 7, 8, 1, 6. And this, any way you add it up, it can be slanty-wise, it can be up and down, back and forth, it'll always equal 15. Your line of numbers always equals 15. And it's just kind of neat. This is 15. 8 plus 6 plus 1 is 15. 2 plus 5 plus 8 is 15. They're all, no matter where you draw the line, it's 15. And it's just kind of neat. And the Chinese did a lot of that. And in doing that, they learned to work with numbers. They learned to understand numbers. They learned to enjoy numbers. And then they did some insane things with these numbers they learned to love. So you remember Archimedes and his 96-agon going around the circle. He's finding pi in there. He has the circle here. He's got a shape on the outside and a shape on the inside. And they're getting... Oh, that's awful. Anyway, and they're getting closer and closer and closer until he's got a shape with 96 sides on the outside and 96 sides on the inside. And he's trying to find that mythical number of pi in between them. Finer and finer calculations. Well, Archimedes was doing great with getting to his 96-sided figure. But Chinese were absolutely obsessed with getting pi right. And instead of stopping with a 96-agon, there was a Chinese named Lu Hu who went 5 more stages to a 3072-agon. Correctly calculating, that's beside the point. But a few years later, another guy named Tsa Tsung Chi took it 3 more steps to a shape with 24,476 sides. And this is mathematics at a level that's really hard to imagine. They're calculating. We talked about a little bit yesterday how they actually calculated, try to find the number of pi. And he correctly placed pi between 3.1415926 and 3.1415927, which is just fantastic. And he did it with those rods on tables. Unbelievable. It's like another universe. In the meantime, so over in India, about this time, there's a group of Indians, there's one part of India that has a number system that looks like this. And at first you think it might look like Roman numerals, but it's not quite. It goes like this, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, it's a base 4 number system instead of a base 5.
And I don't know why they did that, because we have obviously five fingers. But I have this theory that the head teacher probably got his thumb lopped off, and he was like, you know what, this is better anyway. And so so we have a base four system, which actually, you know what, they didn't have much other things that went with it. And they never really made much headway. But in another part of India, about 600 years after Christ, the Brahmi system started to, they made a new number system. And it was sort of the experimental Vedic, I don't know what it was. They were trying to come up with a new way of writing numbers. And they wrote nine numbers, and then they wrote a zero. And they thought about zeros, and they thought about how a zero could work, and discovered zero. And I have a whole book on this, and I wish I could tell you a lot about zero and the kind of thinking that it took to reach beyond the normal and to understand zero. And they called it shunno, which is the exact same word they use in Bangladesh today and in India, because it's an old Sanskrit word. And they're really proud of the fact that they found zero. But they weren't really, the Indians didn't really care much about math. Math was more of a philosophical subject instead of a subject you use to make a pyramid with. And so they had this number system, but they did very little with it for many years until it traveled across the deserts, this concept, to Baghdad. And there in Baghdad, we're going to talk about a little bit about how it became one of the most revolution. This number system became one of the most revolutionary concepts in the world. It was the beginning of what we would consider modern mathematics. It was a system of thinking about numbers that was so much better and stronger than anything that was before it that there was no comparison. It was like all of a sudden a bulldozer to a shovel, or the English language to Pig Latin, like we talked about yesterday. It was a tool they could do things with. And I, as a little bunny trail here, I've had a lot of teachers ask me, why do we try to teach Roman numerals in school? And I think Roman numerals or any other or whatever else we may want to teach, I think it's really, really important that we teach them some kind of alternate way of thinking about numbers, right? There are different ways of thinking. There are different number systems, all kinds of different ways to think about numbers, and the more ways we know, the better. I was just stunned that there are different ways of thinking about numbers, that there could be a base 66 system or a base 4 system or a system that only used a line and a dot for all their numbers, and we'll get to that. And it's interesting to think that, you know, the Bible is written, and all the numbers in the Bible, how they would have been written, what numbers they would have used, what hieroglyphics that would have been there. I don't know. It's interesting. So we're trying to get our students to think beyond the normal of numbers. So if we cross the ocean from China and from India, we're going to give them a little bit of break, and because we want to come back to Baghdad for some more really fascinating stuff. But we're going to go here to America, Central and South America. So we know the Incas had truly amazing mathematics because of what they did and the things they discovered and the calendars they made, but we don't know much about it because when the conquistadors came, they destroyed everything of value they could find, of cultural value, of they burned, they destroyed, and we don't know what it was. But one thing we have left is the Quipa. And I know you, I guess that's how you say it, I don't know. But it's the talking knots of Peru. It's a little, I should have brought a picture or something. But it's this little deal with all kinds of strings hanging down from it with different colored wool and leather and different kinds of knots. And they used it to communicate a lot of things, including mathematics. Used them to keep records. And by using these different colors and styles and knots, they could represent almost anything. Now, in the mid 20th century, when they were making computers, developing computers for the first time, they one of the big problems they had to deal with was how to deal with the sums of sums. So you have a calculation and you get an answer, and how do we take this answer and go on and do another answer with it? And then it, more and more complex math. Well, this little knot program they had going on had dealt with that problem centuries before. And fascinating what they did with these things. We don't understand these talking knots, but the scholars who claim, who spend their lives studying them, claim that they're very advanced, and they were much better, much higher mathematics was than the Roman numerals that our European ancestors used for hundreds of years. And then the Mayans in Central America had a base 20 system. You know, the first digit is the ones, and the ones, and then this would be 20s instead of 10s, and then this next one would be 20 times 20, so it'd be 400 would be this next thing. And they had a system like that, which they wrote with two things, a line and a dot, in different organizations, above and below and beside. And the Mayans also had zero. And the neat thing about the Mayan zero is they used a snail shell to represent it, which is a really good idea. It's a nifty idea if you think about a snail shell, because a snail shell has nothing in it, an empty shell. But it had at one time something in it, and it will again one time, maybe. And so it's a really neat thought of zero. Incredibly complicated calendar. If you want to get really complicated with math, try to figure out how to do a calendar. I had a whole talk on calendars, but it was so incredibly boring. I don't know. Anyway, so Islam, back to Baghdad. While Europe, for the most part, languished in the Dark Ages, the world of Islam, learning was flourishing. And they decided to copy this great library of Alexandria. And so they went to Baghdad and they built a library and a learning center that was unequaled anywhere in the world that we know of. And it was big and it was beautiful. And they had a longtime librarian there named Al-Khwarizmi. And again, I'm just assuming this is how you pronounce his name. We get arithmetic from his name. The word arithmetic comes directly from Al-Khwarizmi's name. And there's a way you get from here to there, but I can't remember. So he wrote two books, foundations of math that we use today. The first one was the Hisab al-Jabur wal-Muqabala. Who knows? The transposition by restoration and reduction. In other words, it formalized the math where you use letters to represent numbers. And we know it just by the first part of that weird Arabic name, algebra. And with his new numbers that he borrowed from India, which he wrote in his second book, the Algoritmi de Numero Indorum. We don't have his original Arabic thing, or people don't, but we have some translations, and this is the translation, The Algorithms of Indian Numerals. This book set the standard for the number system the world still uses today. It was more powerful than anything before it, and while the Indians had discovered it, and et cetera, it was Al-Khwarizmi who made it into a language and formalized it. This was world-changing, this mathematics. The world had a new language, a powerful new language that changed mathematics forever. There were also many other famous people that went to this library. One that you've probably heard of, Tabit Ibn Qura. He's the one who first mentioned the chessboard puzzle, where the man who invented chess went to the king, and the king showed it to the king, and the king said, you know, for such a wonderful game, you can pick anything you want. And he said, well, I don't really want much. I mean, I'm just a simple man, but if you would put one grain of rice on the first square and double it and two on the second square and double it four on the third square and eight on the fourth square and, you know, 16 on the fifth square, or however, that's all he really needs. And the king was delighted to grant this request until he started trying to do it. Actually, there's not enough rice in the world to do that. When you start doubling at that kind of a level, anyway, neat little idea. Another thing that, that Muslims are famous for is their art. So according to the Quran, you can't make a face, a human face. You can't make a tree or a flower. And so they made shapes using mathematics. And I was in Istanbul, and I studied some of the some of this artwork and how they made it with lines and measurements, and they had deep mathematical meaning. And it was truly, truly lovely artwork. So they go. So they're over here in Arabia doing these amazing, or not Arabia, in Iran, I guess, doing these amazing things. Iraq. Where is Baghdad? That's what, Iraq. Okay. So they there's a guy named Leonardo de Pisa, or Leonardo from Pisa, this Italian, goes to Algeria to do his trading business. He's a trader. And he gets to Algeria, and he lives there for a while, and he realizes that, well, he's using Roman numerals. These Muslims in Algeria are using something else, and it's weird, and it's strange, and it's way too simple. So he studies it, and he learns it, and he realizes this is unbelievable, the way they're writing these numbers. So he wrote a book. He was blown away. He wrote a book, Libra Bacchi, and it begins like this. Here are the nine figures of the Indians, 9876543211. With these nine figures and the sign zero, which in Arabic is called Zephyrin, any number can be written, as below will be demonstrated. I can't tell you how big of a concept that is for the world. And he took it to Europe, and there was a great celebration, and with this wonderful concept, and those Europeans were very quick to say, that is the stupidest idea we have ever even imagined. Trying to force some new number system on us. How ridiculous do you think we are? And they kept on using Roman numerals for another 200 years. Can't believe they're our ancestors. We've been messing with these Roman numerals for 15 centuries, and no way there can be something better. It took them 200 years to adopt this system, but finally they did. We also know this Leonardo of Pisa by another name. Fibonacci. And again, we get to these Fibonacci numbers, which we chatted just a wee bit about yesterday. It's these recurring numbers we find in nature. The rate of a spiral of plant leaves and pine cones and pineapples and apple cores and the fingerprints of a creator. Even in the world of nature that is so wildly different and strange and unusual, we have order and design at the base of it. And I wanted to demonstrate some of these things, but actually the honest truth is somehow the whole idea of Fibonacci numbers and these decimals that you get, I don't know, it's really complicated in my mind, so I'm going to pass on that. Again, this Fibonacci did not invent these ideas. He discovered them, written in the language of God, and he named them. And now we're basically done with our history, because now we're in the world of modern math. And the rest of mathematics history that we could talk about is just what they did with this new mathematics system, the mathematics system you teach your students. We have Galileo, we have Roger Bacon, Johannes Kepler, amazing men who took mathematics forward with gigantic leaps, largely because they had a tool, a brand new, powerful tool to use. And they loved God, and they wanted to understand His creation. I'm going to insert a little bit here. So there is a feeling today where people say that mathematics and religion and science cannot get along. And that is truly false thinking. There's a feeling that either you're a religious nut and you're weird and you don't face facts, or you're a scientist and a mathematician. And I can't tell you how fundamentally wrong that is. Because if we look at some of the greatest mathematicians that ever lived, a lot of them were Christians. We have Galileo, and he has five principles of mathematics that he talks about. And I'm just going to very, very quickly go over these. First principle, God has written the book of nature in the language of mathematics. Number two, man can read this language. Number three, man can apply mathematics to the study of nature due to its logical structure. This is created mathematics. Handled with care, this language cannot err or go astray. In my own words, Galileo said, the language of math is the most certain and best tool for elevating the mind to divine knowledge. Now, through the ages, mankind has tried to use Bible and the Word of God and God to help sort of swing their hammer, to give them an enforcer. And we see that in the Catholic Church for years and years. He tried to say, God wrote it, we believe it, we do it. And really it was their own ideas that they're trying to put the stamp of God on to make it have some authenticity. Well, Galileo believed that mathematics can help correct some of these flawed, biblically based arguments because essentially it is the language of God. And I believe there's a lot of truth to that. He believed the fundamental truths of nature were in a way the Word of God. Newton saw the great laws of nature as ideas in God's mind and mathematics as providing the tools needed to discern God's law. Gottfried Leibniz, don't know how to say his name again, the founder of calculus. Do any of you know how to say his name?
Leibniz.
Thank you so very much, Malin. He's the founder of calculus. And he believed the deeper you dug into the world of facts and science, the better you could understand God. I don't know. It's a beautiful thought. Mathematics and God goes together because it's the language of God, and the more you study His creation, the more you see and understand of God. So, okay, a few more things here before we go on. There was a man, a Frenchman, I believe, René Descartes. Again, I'm just shooting from the hip here. His mother died when he's a baby. He's a sickly child. He lays in bed all the time, which is not a shabby idea. And one day he's sleeping in the chimney nook and he's dreaming he's a fly flying around the house, which is sounds like a fantastic way to spend a morning. But as he's dreaming about he's being the fly, he all of a sudden realizes in his dream that with three measurements, he can pinpoint where the fly is anywhere in the room. All he needs is a measurement from the side, up and down, and back and forth. And he can tell within a speck where he's at in the room. So he hops up from his dream and he promptly named this new way of thinking about location in math with mathematics as coordinates. And we use them today. We probably use them this very day in getting here. It's these little jumps in human knowledge as we discover more ways of putting into words, putting into this language of mathematics. Oh dear. Okay, so we have Isaac Newton and all the good stuff he did. All these guys. Einstein, Leonard Euler, Carl Friedrich Gauss. That's kind of neat. So Carl Friedrich Gauss, So he's in his classroom. First day of school, whatever grade it was going to. And the teacher hadn't got much sleep the night before and hadn't had his lessons prepared. And so for the first period, he says, you know what, class? Just to get ourselves warmed up after the summer, let's do... You all want you to add up every number from 1 to 100. 1 plus 1, 1 plus 2 plus 3 plus... Is that right? That can't
no,
be right.
No, he stops at 3.
Okay. 1 plus 2 plus 3 plus 4 plus 5 like that all the way to 100. And this was supposed to take them the math period so the teacher could get some much-needed rest. We've been there. We know what the guy was facing. But Carl Friedrich Gauss, he sits there and in exactly 1 minute he raises his hand and said, teacher, I think it might be 5,050. And all he did was this. He went 100 plus 1, 99 plus 2, 98 plus 3, and it always equals 101, no matter what you do, all the way down. And so he just did...
That bell was wrong. Somebody...
Okay, thank you. So 100. So he took 101 times 50, because there's 50 of these combinations, and he was already done. And I've already been there and done that, and it makes you really grumpy at the student. But it's a way of thinking. Mathematics is a lot more about enjoying math and thinking beyond it than it is about slogging along through these long division problems. At least I hope it is. So we're going to shift gears now. I want to read you this little story. Out of a book that is truly an amazing and delightful book. I highly recommend this book, The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat. A truly amazing, interesting story of what happens in people's minds. delightful book. And this written by Oliver Sacks. So, in this book, toward the end, there are twins, and they're extremely retarded. They could never have ever passed first grade. They're older people now. They couldn't do 2 plus 2 and 5 times 5 and whatever else. They can't do that kind of math. Never were able to. But, well, I'll just read about that. And I have some thoughts. This is the story, and you've probably heard of these people before. They're actually sort of famous. Anyway, so we have two boys here. One is Michael and one is John. And then there's some supplementary data here that I want to read. So it is recorded of Sir Herbert Oakley, the 19th century Edinburgh professor of music, that once taken to a farm, he heard a pig squeak and instantly cried, G sharp. Someone ran to the piano and G sharp it was. My own first sight of the natural powers, the natural mode of the twins came in a similar, spontaneous, and I could not help feeling rather comic manner. A box of matches on their table fell and discharged its contents on the floor. 111, they both cried simultaneously. And then in a murmur, John said, 37. Michael repeated this, and John said it a third time and stopped. I counted the matches. It took me some time. And there were 111. How did you count the matches so quickly, I asked. We didn't count, they said. We saw 111. Similar tales were told of Zacharias Daze, the number prodigy, who would instantly call out 183 or 79 if a pile of peas was poured out, and indicate as best he could, he was also a dullard, that he did not count the peas but saw their number as a whole in a flash. Why did you murmur 37 and repeat it three times? I asked the twins. They said in unison, 37, 37, 37, 111. And this, if possible, I found even more puzzling. They should see 111. 111-ness in a flash was extraordinary, but perhaps no more extraordinary than Oakley's G-sharp, a sort of absolute pitch, so to speak, for numbers. But they had gone on to factor the number 111 without having any method, without even knowing in the ordinary way what factors meant. Had I not already observed they were incapable of the simplest calculations and didn't understand or seem to understand what multiplication and division were? Yet now, spontaneously, they had divided a compound number into three equal parts. Anyway, skipping some. I forgot about the matter, but it hardly bore thinking about. I thought about the matter, but it hardly bore thinking about. Then I forgot it. Forgot it until a second spontaneous scene, a magical scene which I blundered into completely by chance. This second time they were seated in a corner together with a mysterious secret smile on their faces, a smile I had never seen before, enjoying the strange pleasure and peace they now seemed to have. I crept up quietly so as not to disturb them. They seemed to be locked in a singular, purely numerical converse. John would say a number, a six-figure number. Michael would catch the number, nod and smile and seem to savor it. Then he, in turn, would say another six-figure number. And now it was John who received and appreciated it richly. They looked at first like two connoisseurs wine tasting, sharing rare tastes, rare appreciations. I sat still, unseen by them, mesmerized and bewildered. What were they doing? What on earth was going on? I could make nothing of it. It was perhaps a sort of game. But it had a gravity and intensity, a sort of serene and meditative and almost gravity and an intensity, a sort of serene and meditative and almost holy intensity, which I had never seen in an ordinary game before, and which I certainly had never seen before in the usually agitated and distracted twins. I contented myself with noting down the numbers they uttered, the numbers that manifestly gave them such delight, which they contemplated, savored, shared in communion. So he goes home, and he's fascinated with these numbers. And he thinks about him. He's like, what could be with these numbers? And so he goes home and he peers around in some of his old books that he had and realized that the numbers they were saying to each other were prime numbers, six-figure primes in the hundreds of thousands. Unbelievable. So there's no way you can calculate these numbers. Well, I'll get to that. I returned to the ward the next day, carrying the precious book of primes with me. He had a book of primes. That's how he looked them up. Again, I found them closeted in their numerical communion, but this time without saying anything, I quietly joined them. They were taken aback at first, but when I made no interruption, they resumed their game of six-figure primes. After a few minutes, I decided to join in and ventured a number, an eight-figure prime. They both turned toward me, then suddenly became still, with a look of intense concentration and perhaps wonder on their faces. There was a long pause, the longest I'd ever known them to make. It must have lasted a half a minute or more. And then suddenly, simultaneously, they both broke into smiles. They had, after some unimaginable internal process of testing, suddenly seen my own eight-digit number as a prime. And this was manifestly a great joy, a double joy to them, because I had introduced a delightful new plaything, a prime of an order they had never previously encountered, and secondly, because it was evident that I had seen what they were doing and that I liked it and admired it and that I could join in myself. They drew apart slightly, making room for me, a new number playmate, a third in their world. Then John, who always took the lead, thought for a very long time. It must have been at least 5 minutes, though I dared not move and scarcely breathe, and brought out a nine-figure number. And after a similar time, his twin Michael responded with a similar one. And then I, in my turn, after a surreptitious look in my book, added my own rather dishonest contribution, a 10-figure prime I found in my book. There was, and for even longer, a wondering still silence. And then John, after prodigious internal contemplation, brought out a 12-figure number. I had no way of checking this, and I could not respond because my own book, which as far as I knew was unique of its kind, did not go beyond 10-figure primes. But Michael was up to it, though it took him 5 minutes, and an hour later the twins were swapping 20-figure primes. At least I assumed this was so, for I had no way of checking it. Nor was there any easy way. In 1966, unless one had the use of a very sophisticated computer, even then it would have been difficult. For whether one uses Eratosthenes' sieve or any other algorithm, there is no simple method for calculating primes. There is no simple method for primes of this order, and yet the twins were doing it. It's mind-blowing. What was happening mathematically, it was impossible. We are all created with beautiful but very different minds. Some are good at normal things, and some of us are not. But being human and sort of results-oriented, we tend to label those who are not good at normal things as stupid. The twins were labeled as stupid. They could not even do simple first or second grade math. But they obviously understood numbers in a way that few people in history have even come close to. Our students all have different, wonderful, created minds. And we all do as well. And I understand we're attempting to prepare them to live in a real world where you do need to know what 2 plus 2 is. And that's our goal. But how quick are we to try to force them into the normal box and then reject them when they do not fit? We tend so quickly to label them so that we can discard them. In recent years, I've heard from many teachers about dyscalculia and students not being able to process math in the normal way, maybe not even process numbers in period. The twins couldn't have passed first grade, but they had this almost supernatural gift of numbers. Now, we probably won't find ourselves with children, people of this magnitude in our classroom. But we will more than likely have children in our classroom with problems. And I feel that so often we as teachers, we have this information we want to teach our students, and we try the front door, if you will, into our students' minds. And when we find that it's locked, we moan and we turn away and we're like, you know what? Couldn't teach him math. And we give up because our teaching never entered in the normal way. But there are other doors to teaching math, and we must seek and try to find them. There are probably people in this world who will never understand even basic math, but I think these are a lot fewer than we think. So I have some tips here. not about how to teach math. Tomorrow is the day we learn how to teach math. But about our teacher focus. These tips right here are much more about what road you should be on as a teacher instead of how to drive the car on the road. Tomorrow is more driving the car on the road. Today is finding the road as a math teacher. Number one, teach math as a language. As a story. And I don't know. You're going to have to find your way through that. It's the language of the universe. It's words with meaning. A five is not an abstract five. It means five apples. It's communicating something. These numbers, a half is a half a pie that was a little smaller than your brother's half, which maybe isn't quite right. But teach that this is a language communicating things. Number two, make abstract math concepts as physical and hands-on as you can. And that's one of the beauties of mathematics, especially in the lower grades. You can make it into objects. You can make it so they can touch and handle it. Think of the Chinese and their rods, or the Arabs and their dust and their rocks. Make it something they can feel. Number three, get advice from other teachers. We have such a tremendous resource group around us, and we don't use it so often. Number four, if your method isn't working, try a new method. And that seems really stupid, but so when I was over in Bangladesh teaching the first while, we had this deal with my students and I that I would teach them English and they would teach me Bangla. And they had only one real method for teaching Bangla, and that was to shout random Bangla words at top volume at me. And it was a reasonable method, you know, as far as it went, but I didn't know what the words meant. And so when I wasn't learning, you know, quickly, they would give me like 100 new vocabulary words. And they assumed that it was a hearing deficiency. And so they got closer, and they shouted louder, and they said it even faster. And you know what? It wasn't that. The method was actually the wrong method. It wasn't a hearing problem. I heard them the first time. But I sometimes think of us teachers, hey, how often are we doing that? We're in our classroom and the student's not getting it. So we say it louder and a little faster with a little more heat. You know what? If the man didn't get it the first time, more than likely he's not going to get it just with a little more frustration. You know, rarely helps them understand. A little bit more on that a little bit later. Remember, it is more important, and this is my own thought, number five, and maybe it's wrong, but I believe it. Remember, it is more important to teach a student to love and enjoy even only simple math than for you as a teacher to turn math into something they fear and despise. Because we're trying to teach these children how to love to learn, and to love numbers, specifically here in this class. We want them to enjoy math. We want to find ways to have it make it into something beautiful. But to have math become this terror that they dread, that's not, you know what? That's not going to do them any good in the rest of their life. To try to make it, I don't know, the hammer rarely works when you're trying to pound things into people's head. Remember, many times the problem is you as a teacher, and you have a language barrier. So often I have experienced this. You're in your classroom and you're saying it clear as can be, and these students don't get it. You say it with eloquence, you say it with fervor, you say it seven different ways, and they have no idea. And finally, in frustration, one of the other students goes, "Oh! Okay," and they understood, right? It makes you feel really amazing as a teacher. Like, you know what, why don't you just finish the class? That was amazing. But you know what? Tap into your students. If one of them understands it, say, you know what, could you help explain it? Because it does two things. It helps that student put it into words, which is often really hard for the great math brains among us. They know the answer, but they have no idea how to let somebody like me follow their process. So it does wonderful things for your classroom. Let your students help you as a teacher. Use number seven. Use all of your resources. Maybe you all do this, but I forget that I have so many resources. I have hands-on things. I have worksheets. I have students. I have parents. I have tutors. There's so many resources we can find, and use them all. Don't feel like just because, I mean, we can just use one resource a little bit harder and faster and have it work. And then lastly here, for those of you who are sort of obsessive like me and can't lay things down and sort of keep on, well, just sort of control freak obsessing about your students, you can't do more than your best. You give it everything you've got. And you actually can't do more than that. And some people maybe never will learn that. But you can keep trying. My experience as a teacher, especially with math, you guys know my skills at math by now. Teaching math for me is a marathon, and it's not a sprint. And I keep trying, and I keep trying. And the students keep trying, and we learn a lot of things as we stumble along in this marathon. Give your students back to God. You'll never be able to chase them as far or as fast as you can lead them. So, God bless you all very much. And tomorrow we will talk about specifically teaching math. How do you teach mathematics? Thank you so much.